dear students, dear colleagues. I'll just come right to the point. So I'm interested in this most mysterious aspect of the mind-body problem, what philosophers call qualia. So qualia are just the various elements that make up our conscious sensation. There's a qualia for red, there's a qualia for pain, there's a qualia for being Christoph, there's a qualia for being angry, and they all share these different qualia. What they all share is the subjective stance. And Francis and my claim has always been that if we want to have, that if we believe that science should have a complete description of everything in the universe, then that description has to include a theory of consciousness. Otherwise, we're just missing something. Otherwise, we're just missing a major aspect of reality. Yes, it's difficult. Studying consciousness is not like doing physics because of the problem of the first person account, but that doesn't mean it's impossible to solve, and we should get to it in an empirical manner. So, as George mentioned, this, the conceptual part of this has been carried out with Francis Crick, and I wanted to give you a short clip. This clip of a video was done shortly before his death at age 88.
Well, there are various things people want to know. Back to the general questions is, what is the nature of memory? We already know that there are several types of memory. The one way of expressing it is that the memory of knowing what you had for breakfast is not the same type of memory as the memory of the what the word breakfast means, or the third type, the memory of how you eat your breakfast. Those are different sorts of memories. We even have a beginning of understanding some of the molecular, some of the key molecules underlying one of those sorts of memories, one of the so-called glutamate receptors and so on. That's one sort of problem. But perhaps the key problem is how is what is called consciousness, and in particular, to take a simple example, how it is we see things, how you're aware of the visible world outside. Why is it you don't just behave as an automaton with no picture of the world in your head, as it were, but just simply behave, as you can have automata in factories nowadays, making motor cars and things of that sort. They sense what the thing is in, and then they make the right operations and so on, but there's no evidence that they've got any awareness. So that is, again, is one of the key problems. And then the more elaborate forms of awareness, like self-awareness, or it's perhaps one people would say the simpler ones, like feeling pain, for example. So those are the major problems.
So essentially he gives the summary of our approach, that we study visual consciousness because it's the most accessible. We can manipulate in a lab. I'll show you a few illusions. We can now do what magicians can do. We can routinely manipulate what you see, although you may be looking at something, you don't see it, just like in a magic show. And we can manipulate your conscious perception in space and time with great precision. We cannot do that as well as for more elaborate forms of consciousness like self-consciousness. Or like pain, it's much more difficult to recruit subjects to do really experiments with pain consciousness for obviously reason. So that's why we study, I mean, personally I study, and most people in the field now study visual consciousness. So first of all, conceptual distinction, there are at least two different usage of the word consciousness. First of all, it relates to different states of conscious. So hopefully at this point you're still all conscious, nobody's asleep, at least yet. So that's one form of consciousness, and then of course you can up and down regulate that. You can be in sleep, in slow wave sleep, or in REM sleep. You can be in coma, you can be in persistent vegetative syndrome, like a state like Terry Schiavo was. So those are different states of consciousness, and it's a great clinical concern to understand the neural basis of that. Then the other form of consciousness is relates to the current content of consciousness. So right now, your consciousness should be filled with my voice. Or you may have your little toe hurts, and so the content of your consciousness consists of the qualia that you have, the pain in your little toe. Or you may worry about, you know, tax day is approaching, so your content of consciousness is filled with worrying about taxes. So all these different things come with this qualia, and so the question is very simply, what is in the brain that gives rise to these conscious sensations? Because, as Francis said, many things, in fact, most things in our brain, most things in our body go on perfectly well without consciousness. And the second part is easier to investigate than the first part. The second part, as I mentioned, we can manipulate quite well now the content of consciousness, very precise in space and time. This one is much more difficult to manipulate. I mean, you go to bed, of course, each night and consciousness is turned off, but it's not a very clean transition. It takes time and all sorts of other things happen at the same time. You can't move, for instance, your memory goes away, and so it's not a very clean experimental way to do this. So what are some of the things that we know for sure? Well, so consciousness is associated with certain types of complex adaptive networks with massive feedback. If you look at the networks that have consciousness associated with them, they all have, they're very adaptive, they're very complex, they have high degree of feedback, and they're shaped by natural selection. So we obviously think, like most of us, that consciousness gives the organism who is conscious some evolutionary advantage. That's why consciousness evolved. Now, it's not associated with lots of other complex adaptive biological networks. Like many of you, well, some of you may know that down here in your gut, you have 100 million neurons. It's called the enteric nervous system. And usually you're totally and happily, by the way, oblivious of it. Because if you are, if you know something about, usually it's you get feelings of nausea or other, you know, other negative sensations. So here you have neurons and they have synapses and they have neurotransmitter, but by and large they do not give rise to consciousness. So we have to ask, where's the difference between the enteric nervous system and supposedly things in my head? There are other complicated networks like the immune system. There's no evidence that we're conscious of any of the actions of our immune system, yet it's highly complex. It learns. It's a biological network. It was shaped by force of natural selection. So we have to ask, why isn't the immune system conscious? So those are some of the basic questions we don't know. We believe, like again, like many biologists, that many species share aspect of consciousness with humans. Particularly if you broaden consciousness, not only to include self-consciousness, but include pain and pleasure and seeing and smelling and happiness and anger and all these other states. Why do we believe that? Well, a similar behavior, right? If you look at a dog, I love dogs. If you look at dogs, the dog's behavior is not identical to ours, but it's quite similar. The structure of the nervous system of a dog is very similar. If I give you a little cubic millimeter of dog brain, of macaque brain, and a human brain, only very few people, only specialized neuroscientists can tell the difference, because at the hardware level, there's almost no difference. Human brain is bigger. Of course, it's not the biggest brain. That's whales and dolphins. But if you look at the hardware itself, with one or few minor exceptions, like spindle cells, it doesn't look that different. And of course, that's a large degree of evolutionary continuity. So the assumption is that not only you guys out there are conscious, because you've got to remember, I don't know whether you're really conscious, right? I infer you're conscious because, again, you're very similar to me, and you look very similar to me, and your brain is very similar to me. Well, we just extend that argument a little bit to other creatures that maybe walk on four legs or that are a little bit more hairy. The thing is, we don't know the minimal size of a brain necessary to be conscious. We really have no idea. So if you look at, for example, if you look at insects, most people instinctively say, well, that's a bug, and bugs aren't conscious. I can just squish bugs. But if you look at the complex adaptive behavior of a bee, and if you look at what a bee is capable of in terms of single trial learning, very adaptive behavior when it flies through mazes to find sugar, what the feats of sort of code intelligence it can do is quite prodigious. So it's really, we really don't know whether it doesn't feel like something to be a bee. So I think right now it shows up the problem that we don't have a Turing test. We don't have a clear test that tells us whether a creature is conscious. We think it's conscious if it talks. That's been sort of the conventional criterion. Of course, many philosophers believe, or many linguists believe, that's the definition of consciousness. But that's, of course, putting the horse before the cart. Just because we talk and we are conscious doesn't mean that consciousness is tied up with or depends on language. Is there a way we can kill that light? Thank you. So this is, you know, people say, well, let's define consciousness. Of course, and you know, you have to define your terms before you do experiments. Of course, historically, nothing could be further from the truth. In all sciences, you make progress in the absence of precise definition. I mean, look at today, the issue of how to define a planet, right? It hasn't stopped people from finding planets. So if you fix it, what you should do here is just fixate that cause. Don't move your eyes. Keep your eyes open. Fixate the cause. And then tell me what you see. Yeah, somebody said already. What do you see?
The squares disappear.
Do you all see that? So it works best if you don't move your eyes. The less you move your eyes, the better it works. And one square will disappear, or sometimes both squares will disappear, only for brief times, like 2 or 3 seconds. Most of you should be able to see that. Otherwise, you should come see me afterwards. So here you have... So this is an illusion, in fact, that was described a few years ago here at Smith Cadwell in San Francisco. It's called emotion-induced blindness. So it's one of many, many illusions we have in the visual domain where we can make things disappear. Here it's not very well controlled. It depends on the eye movement. If you come to the lab, I can control it much better. So the point is the yellow squares are present all the time, yet sometimes you see them and sometimes you don't see them. And when you see them, you're conscious of them. You can talk to your neighbors about them. They remind you of yellow. They remind you of the yellow sun, of yellow Van Gogh, sunflower. Whatever. That's what we mean by consciousness. And sometimes they're there, they're on your retina, but you don't see them. You're not conscious of them. So this is what sort of our quest reduces to. Where's the difference in your brain between when you're conscious of these and when you're conscious and when you're not conscious of these? And the hypothesis is, it may be wrong, but the hypothesis is that once we understand something as simple as visual consciousness, we're probably a great step further along the road to understand any forms of consciousness, including self-consciousness or in high-level aspects of consciousness. Right, so Francis and I focused very early on because this field has a 2,000-year history of failure, we want to focus on something where we can actually make progress in our lifetime. And so most people agree that something we can make progress on, particularly given the state of neuroscience today, is the neuronal correlates of consciousness. It's abbreviated as NCC here. And the NCC are just the minimal neuronal mechanisms that are necessary for any one specific conscious content. So minimal because we know the entire brain is necessary. But let's say for those yellow spots I showed you, do you need your eyes? Well, we know you don't need your eyes to see because you can close your eyes and you can still imagine, most of us can still imagine the yellow squares. And of course, at night, most of us have very vivid visual dreams with your eyes closed. So that tells you for certain forms of seeing, the eyes are obviously necessary, but for other forms of seeing, the eyes are not necessary. Is the cerebellum necessary? Well, probably not. There's no evidence that the cerebellum is necessary for any forms of consciousness. So you can ask, where are the neuronal mechanisms? Where are the neurons? In what type of the brain are they? That are necessary for one specific conscious content, pain or pleasure or seeing green or seeing yellow squares, whatever. Is there anything common about them? Are they located in a specific part of the brain? Are they a specific type of cell, like a pyramidal cell? Do they sit in a particular type, let's say a layer 5 and project forward? Are there particular molecular signatures for them? You can ask all those questions once you have a neuronal correlate. And once again, you want to distinguish this from the correlates that you need to study states of consciousness. Those are reasonably well understood, right? From the 40s and 50s, we know in the brainstem there's a whole set of system that used to be called collectively the ascending arousal system that's necessary for you to be conscious at all. But here it's much more specific. We're interested in the NCCs for seeing blue or for smelling mom's apple pie. And for every such conscious attribute, no matter what it is, if you think, if you have angst and alienation because we live in a post-industrial society, well, that's a conscious feeling. There has to be a neural correlate for that. There has to be an NCC for that. Now, as I mentioned, there are many, many brains inside your head. We know this. This in a philosophical context, this was first raised by Schopenhauer and probably Nietzsche, and then, of course, Freud in a literary, medical context. But we know that from the lab, through the works of many people, things like climbing, running, driving, biking, chewing gum, talking, all those things you can do perfectly well unconsciously. So in fact, when you give a talk like this, or when you just have a normal conversation and you try to think about having the conversation while you're actually having it, you realize that it's not conscious. It's not there isn't a little Christoph inside my head who says, okay, this is what I want to say. This is the verb. This is the noun. This is in German. Now I translate it, and then I send it off to my speech apparatus. It doesn't happen like that. I have a vague idea what I want to say next, and the next thing I hear, these words come pouring out of my mouth. And it's a very sophisticated thing, or reasonable sophisticated thing. And so this all happens without consciousness. Same thing, I open my eyes, within a fraction of a second, I see you all. And we don't have access. I can't I can't regress and I can't go to a psychoanalyst and pay $200 an hour and lie down and try to see how do I see stereo or how do I see in color. It just happens. It's magic. It's this wonderful interface. And so those things that we are very proud of, those things we can introspect, those things that the adage of Western philosophy, know thyself, try to figure out why you really do things, those things are only a very small fraction of all the activities in your brain that you're conscious of. And we think, of course, they're the most important one because we are so proud of consciousness, because that's how we experience world, the world. But we have to ask scientifically, where's the difference at the neuronal level? I'm not going to talk about it today, between these systems. These are very sophisticated systems. They involve subcortical structures, but they also involve cortical structures that are involved in things like playing soccer or running down. I mean, you know, when you run in the mountain, it's amazing. You can run at high speed down a mountain. You have to make very quick decisions where you put your feet in a fraction of a second, yet your body does it for you. So there are very complicated computations that have to go on, depending on the visual input and the state of my body, etc. Yet you do it all. So you can ask the question, what's the character of these systems as compared to the neuronal character of systems that actually give rise to consciousness? So Francis and I call these zombie systems. These are not the philosophical zombies. These are different zombie systems that you have. They're zombies in the sense that it doesn't feel like anything. You can be, of course, conscious of running down, but you can show in the lab that consciousness comes after the fact. That, you know, actually moving, you know, you can respond so quickly that the consciousness for that motion doesn't come till after you've already initiated the motion. So it has to work without consciousness. So these conscious systems are complemented by a general purpose system whose function is, and this is our speculation, whose function is to summarize the current content of my environment and make this summary available to the planning stages of my brain. Like any information processing system, I always suffer from informational overload. There's vastly more information streaming in through my various sensors, the auditory, the visual sensors, than I can possibly compute in real time. So what my brain does, it makes a quick summary of the environment. So it says there are people there and there are walls here, I'm in an audience, and then this summary is made accessible to my planning stages. So for instance, let's say if there's a fire here, or if there's an earthquake, and I quickly have to think, you know, what's the best way to aggress here, right? What's the best way to exit? That's what I need consciousness for those sorts of things that I haven't done over and over and over again. Because if I train it over and over again, I train up a zombie system, I probably train up my basal ganglia, and I don't need consciousness for that. So you have these two sets of systems. You have this zombie system, and then there's complemented by a more general purpose conscious system that does this planning that involves the frontal lobes. Oh yeah, I found this wonderful quote from an old book. Well, it's actually not that old. From an old book, Herigel. So he's a German philosopher who went to before the war, who went to Japan and learned art then and the art of bow with these big bows. And in the last chapter, he talks about then and the art of fencing. And he has this wonderful quote: "The pupil must develop a new sense, or more accurately, a new alertness of all of his senses, which will enable him to avoid dangerous thrusts as though he could feel them coming. Once he has mastered the art of evasion, he no longer needs to watch with undivided attention the movements of his opponent, or even of several opponents at once. Rather, he sees and feels what is going to happen. At the same moment, he has already avoided its effect without there being the hair's breadth between perceiving and avoiding. This, then, is what counts, a lightning reaction which has no further need of conscious observation. In this respect, at least, the pupil makes himself independent of all conscious purpose, and that is a great gain." Of course, these things, these zombie systems, only you have to train them up, and in this case, these monks, of course, they train for years and years and years and years before they can do that. All right, so what's the experimental program I'm going to talk about? Well, so first of all, the point is consciousness is an empirical problem. It's primarily an empirical problem. It used to be primarily a philosophical problem, but things have changed now, and there's some very interesting philosophical work going on, but by and large, most of the progress now happens on the empirical side. And the experimental program essentially is to track down the NCC, to identify which neurons in what part of the brain, what species is involved in conscious perception, and then in activating them, you want to move from correlation to causation, of course. This is very difficult to do in humans. That's why you need animal models, right? You want to say, when I'm conscious of red, those neurons fire, but I want to say, if I can get those neurons to fire by manipulating them genetically or pharmacologically or iontophoretically or electrically, then I create the consciousness of red, right? You want to move from correlation to causation, which you can do in humans, but of course it's you can do it much more controlled in animals. And so if you want to do these animal studies, that really requires a practical tests. Just like the Turing test for intelligence, you want a battery of behavioral assays that tells you this individual, whether it's a baby or whether it's a fetus or whether it's a patient who's aphasic or whether it's a patient who looks like he's in coma or people like Terry Schiavo. We want a behavioral assay, or whether it's a monkey or fly or any other organism, we want to have a series of behavioral tests to tell us whether this organism right now has conscious sensation, has conscious behaviors. And again, you just do it by analogy with a normal human. You say, well, in normal humans, you can do this battery of tests, and these tests require consciousness. And then you apply this sort of appropriately adapted behavioral assays to other things, like to babies or like to mice. All right, so let me show you a few effects. So what you should do, you just should look at the cause here. Maybe we can once again turn off the light. Ellen, I wonder whether we can turn once again the thank you. And just while I talk, just look at the cause here. This is the oldest technique in psychology. It's the easiest to use, and it's the oldest, one of the best studied. And just keep your eyes fixed there, don't move them. And then what do you see now? We can do this again. So just look at the cause. Don't move your eyes. And what you should see... Well, hello. Yeah. I mean, do you see these colors? You can move back and forth, and after a while, the colors really become very vivid. Again, here, you don't want to move your eyes. Moving your eyes minimizes the after effect. So here, by the way, this argues against the naive notions of naive realism. Naive realism just says, well, there's a world outside there, and there's a one-to-one mapping between the world outside and the consciousness in my head. Well, here, the world is actually gray, but at least for a certain time, I saw it in color, although there's no color in this case present in the world outside. So you can now ask a question, you can combine, so this is an after effect, it's called the color after effect. You can, I'm sorry, we need to have the light out once again. Remember this illusion. So here sometimes you see the yellow squares and sometimes you don't. And I don't see the laser pointer. All right. So the question is, this seems like silly and couldn't be answered a couple of years ago, but now can scientifically. Do you need to see the yellow squares in order to get a yellow after effect? So once again, just indulge me and just keep your eyes fixed on the cause. And then you should be able to see an after image here. To the yellow square, do you see it? All right, so we can ask the following question in the lab. Let's see, for 2 seconds you didn't see the yellow square. Let's see, even better, for 2 seconds you saw the left yellow square, but you didn't see the right yellow square, okay, because it was perceptual suppressed. Now I look at the strength of the after effect. Is there a difference between the after effect between the one on the left that you saw for 2 seconds and the one that you didn't see? And the answer is very unambiguous. In this case, it doesn't matter whether you consciously see the after effect, you still get it. The after effect does not depend on consciousness in this case. Why is that interesting? You could say, well, that's a little, arcane thing. Well, it teaches you a valuable fact about consciousness. In this case, it tells you that after effect, color after effect, happens in the brain in the hierarchy. There's a processing hierarchy that goes from the retina to the LGN to the various stages of the visual brain. And in this processing hierarchy, the step where the visual after effect happens, which is mainly in the retina, although not exclusively, occurs before the stage in the brain where consciousness happens. Visual consciousness for color happens at a higher stage. So therefore, the after effect just depends mainly on how long the retina was stimulated by the yellow. But consciousness happens, let's say, in the brain proper, not in the retina. So therefore, whether or not you see the yellow square doesn't impinge at all on the strength of the after effect. That's useful because A, it shows you can make progress on these difficult questions, and B, it tells you consciousness is not this delocalized. When you hear many scientists speak about consciousness, they get suddenly, these are reduction scientists, but then they get very misty-eyed and talk and wave their hand. They talk about gestalt and holistic and emergent property, and it all gets very fuzzy. But here, this is just the moral of 20th century biology applied to these problems. Consciousness is all about specific. There are going to be specific neurons with specific molecular and synaptic constituency that are responsible for generating specific forms of consciousness. And this tells you that the site where consciousness is generated for yellow squares is not the entire brain, but is somewhere specific and above the stages where after effect happens. Now, there are other after effects. For instance, you can look at this picture. And you can be happy or you can cry. So, who sees John Kerry? And who sees George W? And who sees John Kerry here? Anybody? And what about this? Who sees John Kerry here? There are many more. Okay, this image is actually exactly the same as the first image. So I showed three images. I can do this again. This is an image. I mean, you have to do this on a person-by-person count, but, you know, so I'm doing it here for everybody, because everybody's slightly different, of course. Here the images, and Mike Weir did this, was morphed, so half the, so roughly half the time you will see George W., and half the time you'll see you see Kerry, okay? Then you looked at an image, 100% George Bush, and then I showed you the same image again, but now because you adapted to George Bush, you are less likely to see George Bush and more likely to see John Kerry, bless his soul. So, right, I was supposed to talk about the soul. So this is it's a different after effect. It's called the face-specific after effect. So not only can you have adaptation for colors, but you can also adapt to faces. And you just showed, I just showed you one consequence of that. So again, we can ask a similar question. This is more tricky to arrange experimentally, and I won't bother you with the detail. Essentially, what we can do for experts, we use binocular rivalry. We show an image of one of four different faces in one eye, we project a face into one eye, and then for 4 seconds we hide it from view by showing a series of other of flashing things and moving dots in the other eye. So perceptually, although one face is present for 4 seconds, you don't see it consciously. Okay, it's a quite reliable technique. And then we test adaptation. And we test it by doing careful psychometric, using four different faces. You have to tell us which of four different faces is present. And what you can see here, that if you don't see the face, you don't get the shift in the psychometric curve. In other words, if you do not consciously see the face you were supposed to adapt to, you don't get the after effect. So unlike for color, where you don't need to see the inducer in order to get the after effect, if you don't see the inducing face, you don't get the after effect. So this tells us that consciousness for faces has to be at the same location or before the location where after effect happens. And so again, we know something about the site of after effect using fMRI in faces. So again, it tells us something where in the processing hierarchy consciousness, in this case for faces. Because of course, there's no guarantee that consciousness for faces is going to be generated by the same neurons that generate consciousness for yellow squares. Those are different things, and they may well involve different neurons. The question is there anything common about those neurons? Like, are they all layer 5 pyramidal cell that project their axons down to the pulvina or something like that? That's a question people are asking. So this shows you can do what's called psychophysics. You can use psychology to infer something about anatomy, called psychoanatomy. Now, you can also use fMRI. I'll show you a simple fMRI experiment. Probably most of you have seen this. This is change blindness. It's discovered by, or was popularized by, these people at the Nissan Center. So it's two images. It's the original image, and then the images was doctored, and you probably all see the change. Don't say what it is. Who sees the change? All right, not everybody. That's a big change. This should worry you if you don't see it. You see it there? Okay, this is Koss, Christmas at Koss in Southern Cal. You can see it's German Christmas. Those are my dogs. What do you see the change? It's a big change. It's not the dogs. Yeah. Snow rug. Okay, I can show you a third illusion. Can we have that light off, please? This is a difficult one, and you have to concentrate. And I would ask you, please, not to cheer or talk to your neighbor, just to be very quiet. It's a difficult and demanding one. I'll show you a video with six people, three people dressed in black T-shirts and three people dressed in white T-shirts. And the two groups of three people each have a basketball, and they're bouncing it among each other. And your mission is to count, to neglect the people in the black T-shirts and just count how often do the people in the white T-shirts pass the ball. Okay, so please be quiet. And it takes like 20 seconds, so you have to concentrate. So how many people saw the gorilla? It's about two-thirds of you. We can do it again here. Now, you know, this makes you skeptical when you go to witnesses, right? So, it's quite troubling, because here what you have an event that's perfectly visible for 5 seconds. It's a big event, right? It's an unusual event. I mean, you don't have that many gorillas walking across office corridor, yet, you know, and this gorilla takes 5, 6, 7 seconds to calmly walk across, and many of you totally miss this event. So, again, it shows our limited ability to actually see, particularly to see unexpected things, right? And I cleverly, of course, I misdirected you. If I would have told you something interesting is going to happen, tell me what it is. I mean, then probably 99% of you would have seen it. Anyhow, so this is known as change blindness. It's a large set of different illusions, and it just tells that we may be blind to large changes in the environment. It also, you know, we also have this illusion, I open my eyes, I see everything. And of course, the last three, this and the previous one shows you don't see everything. You have what psychologists call gist. You have a very quick impression of, yeah, this is an office, you know, it's an audience. And then you see at any given point in time one or two things. All right, so we can now ask, what's the correlate of that in a magnet? We can look at it in a human. For example, the first part, so the visual input goes from the eye through an intermediate relay to the back of your head. You can all feel it here. There's a little bump at the back of your head. And a little bit above that bump is your visual cortex. So if somebody whacks you with a baseball bat, which you shouldn't do, you can feel stars. That's because you're mechanically stimulating this brain. So we can ask a question now in an fMRI, in a magnetic scanner, for example, to what extent do the neurons in the first cortical stage of vision, do they reflect what's just coming in from the retina? Do they reflect the physical input, or do they reflect already the conscious perception? Now, of course, we can't use really this gorilla, because you can only use that one, obviously. So we do a much more difficult task, much more boring, of course. We're scientists after all. So we get you to fixate here, and then you have these rings you have to monitor, and you have to tell us when one of the orientation on the rings changes. And for example, this just flipped. And it's a difficult task, and even if you're, you know, 18 and well-rested and very alert, you will miss a large number of these changes, just because the nature of our visual system. Of course, we designed this display to be difficult to find all these changes. Although once I point them out to you, of course, you see them. So now we look inside your skull, we look at in your various, in the back of your head, as I said, there's primary visual cortex, there's secondary visual cortex, and we can essentially look at here we're not looking at neurons, we're looking at a proxy, we're looking at changes in blood flow. Essentially what fMRI gives you is power consumption of the brain. If those neurons are a little bit more active, they consume more power, they need oxygen, they need ATP, ATP needs oxygen, oxygen is transported in with the red blood cells, they rush in, and that's essentially what we're tracking. We're looking at deoxyhemoglobin. And it's sluggish, it's over big areas, many cubic millimeter. You got to remember, per cubic millimeter, there are 100,000 different cells in each cubic millimeter, and a few million, 800 million synapses per cubic millimeter and 2 kilometers of axon wiring. So here we're looking at big areas and very sluggish. This is time scale of seconds. And what you see here you see the signal in response when one of the ring flips its orientation and when you actually saw it, called a hit. So the person tells me by pushing the button for ring number three just flipped. And then you see a signal here. It's small, it's 0.25%, but it's highly reliable. You can measure it, that's a standard deviation. You can measure it very reliable. It increases and it decreases with a slow time scale. All right, that's expected. Then what happens if you miss a change? So miss change, there was a change there, but you didn't perceptually see it. Well, in that case, sort of the signal is green. It's sort of more or less noise. So physically, there's no difference between the green and the blue curve. In both cases, there was a change outside in the image, that in print was highly, you know, it was in principle clearly visible, but I didn't see it because I didn't attend to that. The subject didn't see it. So the subject didn't see it, it doesn't register in the bold response. Conversely, here the person thought there was, incorrectly, he thought there was a change, but really there wasn't a change. And then the signal you get is almost the same as the signal you get when actually there was a change and the person saw it. In here one, there wasn't a change and the person didn't see it. So what's remarkable that if you compare green and blue, in both cases there was the same physical input, but here there was consciousness associated with it, and here there was not. Red and blue are the same conscious events. In both cases, the person saw, at least claimed he saw, he pushed the button, that there was this, he saw this change in orientation. In one case there was, in one case there wasn't. So here you can clearly see that in the, already at the level of primary visual cortex, as far as you can tell in a magnet, the signal in cortex itself followed the conscious perception rather than the physical signal. All right. So let me tell you about the last experiment. This is very new. Just, everything I'm talking today is about humans. I guess I didn't put in any animal experiments. I just realized. So most of what we, 99.9% of what we know about the brain, we know about animals, from animal brains. Particularly, almost everything we know about nerve cells, neurons, we know from animals. And if you want to understand the analogy I made this morning, if you want to understand chemistry, you need to know about molecules. If you want to understand physics, you need to know about atoms or subatomic particles. Likewise, if you want to understand perception, consciousness, memory, action, you must know about nerve cells. Nerve cells are sort of the atoms of the nervous system. And there are, you know, 100 billion of them in the brain, and you want to query them, you want to listen to them. In general, that's very difficult to do in humans, obviously. But there are conditions, so this is sort of the people in my lab who did this. He's now at MIT, he's now in England, and we do this in the lab of the neurosurgeon Itzhak Fried at UCLA. There are a few conditions when you can actually record from neurons in the human brain, and the advantage is you can directly ask them about, are they conscious? You can get them to play video games, all sorts of things, and they can directly tell you about their state of consciousness rather than you have to infer it indirectly. So the setting here is you have epileptic patients that are severe epileptic. In other words, the pharmacological intervention doesn't work anymore or doesn't work very well. So these patients may have 1 or 2 or 10 seizures a day. You got to realize if you have one seizure here in California, next half year you're not allowed to drive anymore. So seizures seriously impairs, you know, has seriously adverse consequences on your quality of life. So then what you do as a very successful intervention, the surgeon goes in, identifies where the focal seizure is, if there is a focal seizure, and takes out that part of the brain from which the seizure originates. And by and large, it's a very successful operation. In some subset of patients, you can't do that. You look at from the outside, you do EEG, you do MRI, and you don't know, the brain looks relatively normal. You can't identify where's the part of the brain, where's the seed, if you want, inside the brain from which the seizure originates. Then what the surgeon does, it's like Fried, and this is also done here by Berger, for instance, and by other people at UCSF. It's done at many places throughout the country in the world. You insert various types of electrodes. So these are so-called depth electrodes. So here you insert them. Here you typically 10 or 12 of them. You drill a little burr hole, and you insert the depth electrode here into the brain. In this case, part of the brain called the hippocampus. And then you use these leads. These are platinum-iridium contacts. You essentially use these leads to do like EEG, except they're inside the cranium, intracranial EEG. And essentially, the patient is then hooked up to a machine that's monitored 24/7. The patient stays in the ward for, here you see a patient in the bed, you know, since there are no pain receptors inside the brain itself, the patient doesn't need to be anesthetized, so the patient's sitting in the bed and lying and reading or watching TV, talking to his mom, whatever, while there are these 10 or 12 microprobes inside his head, that you can see the wire goes to his bedstand, and these are being monitored, and then if he has seizures, you can now the neurologist can essentially triangulate where the seizure originates. Then they take out the electrode, then they take out the part of the brain that gives rise to the seizure. What Fried did and his collaborators, they added tiny wires here. They moved through, they hollowed out this inner volume of this microelectrode, of this electrode, and they inserted these wires. So essentially we have 9 wires. And so we have 10 of these big micro wires, and then each one has 8 or 9 or 10 micro wires. So we have on the order of 100 wires in the head of a patient. And so we can now do exactly what we can do in an animal. We can listen. We can do a lot of signal processing. I won't bore you about. And you can listen to the individual neurons firing. You can hear them chat away. You can put them on an audio monitor, and you can hear, you may know the way neurons communicate. They have these little, it's an asynchronous pulse code, different from a computer code. They communicate by these little pulses. They're like a millisecond across and maybe a tenth of a volt in amplitude. Particularly if you've got a German accent. So Gabriel Kreiman, who did this early work with PhD, discovered this neuron. So I'll show you a bunch of these graphs. So here what you have, this is time. Time runs this way, from left to right. This is 3 seconds. We show this image, in this case, this house and with a tree, for between those two vertical marks. For 1 second, the patient saw this picture. And for 1 second, the patient saw this line drawings. And here is the firing rate. This is the horizontal bar, gives you the average firing rate. So on average, this neuron fired, you know, I don't know, 2 spikes a second or something like that. And here are the individual trials. So each one of these blips is one of these action potentials that we just average and represent here. So this was early, 5 years ago, and what you can see is that it didn't respond. We showed many, many things. I'm only showing the best responses here. It didn't. Most of the neuron didn't respond at all. This neuron didn't respond to most images except it responded to this image of our ex-chief in commander and a line drawing of him, a presidential portrait of him and him and his wife. Responded very significantly, very strongly. You don't have to do statistics to see this. And here there's another, this is again from Gabriel, another set of neurons that responded to the Beatles or to the Simpsons. And then we got very interested and we started an entire research program to look for these neurons and spent 4 years, this was the work of Quirin Quiroga, to look for these neurons using a whole set of various experimental paradigms. And this is what we found. So again, same thing, this is 3 seconds, 1 second before the image, and for 1 second this image is on shown, and then 1 second after the image. And so these are, here in this case we showed like 88 different images. We are really only limited by how much time we have with the patient. So, you know, the patient may be bored or may go to sleep or, you know, he has to go to the bathroom. So usually experiments are 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes. And here you can see this is a famous actress. Jennifer Aniston, she's called. And you can see the neuron here responds quite nicely to these very different pictures of Aniston here, and doesn't respond. So Aniston used to be married to some other star and doesn't respond when she's there with her, at the time when they were still married, when she's here with her husband, the neuron doesn't fire for whatever reason. And here there are various others. These are other actresses. This is Pamela Anderson. These are famous, you know, like Eiffel Tower, Golden Gate Bridge, Pisa Tower, etc. So this is a neuron that fires very selectively only to pictures of Jennifer Aniston. What we found remarkable as visual scientists is also the degree of invariance, particularly if you're interested in object recognition. In other words, this picture and this picture at the bit level, they differ totally, right? They have different background, different hairdo, yet still the neuron responds to it quite selectively. This is a neuron that responds to the Sydney Opera House. And interestingly, the patient confused this, and it only became apparent, and we are having a new paradigm to exploit this, after we finished the experiment, the patient thought this was actually also the Sydney Opera House. Well, this is actually the Baha'i Temple, which is very interesting. This neuron, and we find a subset of these neurons also respond to strings, letters, called Sydney Opera. So it's a very high level degree of invariance. This is to another actress called Halle Berry. So you can see again they're very different. Here she's in a cat, she plays some cat woman or some woman who runs around dressed in a cat suit. I don't know why actually. There you have a line drawing of her. You have her in a cat suit. You have the text Halle Berry. There's some other woman who's also dressed in a cat suit, but the patient knew that this wasn't Halle Berry. Now, from the same microwire, don't ask me why. So, you know, we can pick up multiple, by listening carefully, by doing what's called cluster cutting using wavelet-based analysis, we can distinguish different neurons from one wire. So from the same wire nearby, there was a different neuron that responded to Mother Teresa. This is a neuron response to Pamela Anderson. This is a neuron, oh yeah, here's her husband, Pitt, that's right. Brad Pitt. So this is a neuron in the same patient as the one I showed you at the beginning, and this this neuron only, but it's on the other side of the, this is in the hippocampus. Oh, I should mention, these neurons, by and large, most of them are in hippocampus, some of them are also in perirhinal cortex and amygdala. We put the electrodes there because the surgeon puts the electrodes there, right? We are, of course, totally dependent on, because we're piggybacking with this experiment onto the clinical experiment. So this was on the other side of the same patients, but the other side of the brain. There's a neuron that responds to Anderson and Brad Pitt, but not to Anderson by herself. Anyhow, so so what we have here are some very specific neurons that respond, that are quite invariant, and they find a very explicit manner and in a very sparse manner to famous individuals. And there are probably going to be many neurons like that that respond to things that the patient is very familiar with, either famous people or familiar things like your mother, you know, your grandmother, you know, the computer phone you use, your dog, things you constantly see. The brain probably wires up neurons that respond specifically to that. Now, if you care about what's BMI, or called brain-machine interfaces, if you want to think, people are starting to think about that, if you want to implant a device into people to help them to see, for example, because they're blind, or to enable them to see, or enable them to move, you want to be able to, what's called decoding. You want to be able to take a group of neurons, record from the activity, and then infer what was present in the environment. It's called a decoding technique. And I'll just show you intuitively what we mean by that. So here you have different images. Here we are recording from 10 units, the same unit, unit one here and unit here, responding to 32 different images. And so now the question is, let's say you have a particular spiking pattern. Can you infer, or with what probability can you infer, based on, unit number two fired strongly, unit number three fired sort of middling, and unit number one, two, and five didn't fire at all. Can I invert the process? Can I say, well, based... Can I essentially read the patient's mind? Can I read the patient's neurons in order to read the patient's mind? Okay, now I can do that quite well with far, far better chance performance. So here I average over all the experimental sessions. This is chance performance always. So here, let's say if I have 30 images present, in order for me to guess which of 30 images present, chance would be 1 out of 30, right, if I just do it randomly. On average, I can do far, far better. So in other words, I can do decoding. I can decode the visual thoughts, quote, from the patient by listening to a small subset. Here we talk, on average, we're talking about 20 to 30 neurons. That the patient, so I can infer what the patient is conscious of by recording from these neurons. Now, that's all still observation. Ultimately, what you would like to do is go to causation. What happens, for example, this is possible in the clinical context. The neurosurgeon does it often. What happens if I stimulate those neurons? Can I create the percept? Can I not only read out, but write in? That's for the future. All right. Let's skip this. And I can also do imagery. We've also done that. I can ask the patient, well, remember I just showed you this picture of Van Gogh. Can you think about that? So here, for example, I have a neuron that responds to the image of Paul McCartney, here the green. And here are the images, when I showed him the images of this house. So you can see whenever the patient saw a photo of McCarthy, it fired relatively, not always, but fired very strongly. When we showed the patient the picture of this house, it didn't fire, or only fired very weakly. Now here, I ask the patient, close your eyes, and for 3 seconds, think about Paul McCarthy. Think about the house, McCarthy house. And again, you can see there's a nice selectivity, that these neurons are as selective, statistically speaking, almost as selective during physical input as well as during imagined input. All right, let me come to a conclusion, to the end, so I have two last slides. So in this quest to study consciousness, what is the long-term strategy? Well, first of all, most importantly, although I didn't actually give you an example, for obvious reasons, mainly because we can intervene in the animal brain, particularly in the brain of mice and monkeys, we can intervene with ever more fancy techniques, particularly with molecular techniques. If we want to understand at the circuit level, if we really want to understand which neurons, in what part of the brain using what circuit, I'd like to understand the series of events that goes from layer 4C alpha to layer 3B involving which interneurons. At this level of specificity, like we can do in molecular biology, I need to intervene with the system. I need to perturb it, and that requires an animal model. So therefore, people are developing sort of the animal models, particularly mammalian models, to study these sorts of things. Then I need to identify the coalition of neurons that give rise to a specific neural college of consciousness. And then I want to deliberately, transiently, delicately, and particularly reversibly, I want to interfere with the neural college of consciousness. For instance, can I take a mutant mouse? Can I use a specific cell-specific promoter to turn on and off consciousness? In other words, can I create a little zombie mouse that can do certain things, like it can do all sorts of behaviors that animals or we can do without being conscious, but it can't do those behaviors anymore that require consciousness. That would be an experimental tour de force. For instance, can we search for random mutations that selectively interfere with consciousness? That's one technique, how you find them using random mutation. Particularly, that's how you do it in the medical pharmacological industry. And then, as I mentioned, in both humans and animals, we need to move from correlation to causation. And finally, none of this is really a theory of consciousness. I have not talked about a theory of consciousness. Ultimately, what we need is what we want is a theory of consciousness. We want to be able to see which systems under which condition are conscious. Why is my, why is my enteric system not consciously? Presumably, why is my immune system not conscious? Why is my brain conscious under certain condition? What about a fly, a fetus, a person like a patient like Terry Schiavo? What about the internet? Ultimately, we would like to answer this question for synthetic devices. Can I make a synthetic device that's conscious? The internet, a robot, a computer. So two concluding remarks. So one is, people say, well, this is all very nice, Professor Koch, and I believe you, in the fullness of time, with adequate funding, of course, we'll be able to understand that if I'm conscious of red, then those neurons will fire in this particular way, and if I'm conscious of pain, some other neurons will fire. Well, so what? That doesn't explain consciousness. Of course, people made exactly the same argument for life. Now, this is an analogy. It may not be right, but I think it may be a very telling analogy. So people in the 20s, 30s, and certainly before in the 19th century, had great difficulties with understanding how life arose. And there's this wonderful quote I discovered from a book. Okay, so Thomas Hunt Morgan, just before he moved from Columbia to Caltech, wrote this book where he summarized his research on fly. Right? He developed the fly as genetic tool. Well, he argued, essentially modern language, that genetic information is stored along one-dimensional strings. And then Bateson, who was sort of England preeminent geneticist, reviewed that. And this is what he said in his review in Science, I think. The properties of living things are in some way attached to a material basis, perhaps in some special degree to nuclear chromatin. And yet it is inconceivable. So that's what Bateson writes, who was a reduction scientist. It is inconceivable that particles of chromatin, i.e. chromosomes, of any other substance, however complex, can possess those powers which must be assigned to our factors or genes. That's his spelling. The supposition that particles of chromatin, indistinguishable from each other, and indeed, of course, this is a killer, almost homogeneous, right? Of course, they're not homogeneous. Almost homogeneous, but they didn't know any better. Under any known test, can by their material nature confer all the properties of life, surpasses the range of even the most convinced materialism. So people said, I don't understand. I understand chemistry, and I don't understand how you can get out of chemistry a single egg, how you can get all the specificity that makes up an individual in the next generation. I know chemistry. It can't happen. I need new laws. I need élan vital. I need a new physics. Even Schrödinger argued that. Well, in fact, of course, what people didn't realize, they didn't understand the prodigious power of macromolecules. You have to understand, when this was written, people didn't even realize that hemoglobin, historically, was a single molecule that in an individual like myself, all the hemoglobin is always exactly the same molecule. They had a science, well, at the time there was a science called colloidal science, which studied the sort of what happened if you have large collection of different molecular weight of the same molecules. They didn't realize that you can store, the great specificity of macromolecules. They didn't realize you can store prodigious amount of information in one-dimensional nucleotide strings. So I don't think we should make the same mistake twice, because you very often hear this argument, say, well, we understand biology, and no matter what, biology or physics, I mean, there's some people even who say, I know physics, I know biology, there's nothing in principle that can explain consciousness. And I think that's a defeatist argument, and we've heard it before when it was wrong. That's not to say it may be right in the future. And lastly, there are also ethical implications of this sort of research, because once we have really a much better, I mean, I think you can see this already today, but certainly in the fullness of time, once we understand which creatures can suffer and which creatures cannot suffer. So, for instance, mammals. If you look at the behavioral evidence, there's no question that all mammals are capable of suffering. They are of course capable of great joy if you have dogs or cats or other animals, but they can also suffer. And particularly the ways we treat animals, particularly in this country. And so I think this research does have ethical implications. Once we have a theory of consciousness, once we can tell with great confidence which animals are conscious and which animals are not conscious, we have to enlarge the circle of life. We have to enlarge the magic circle, those individuals, those organisms to which we say, well, they are special. Right now, the only thing that are really special are us humans, people that look like us, that have two legs, that can talk. But then, of course, there are people who can't talk, the people like Terry Schiavo or other patients that 20 to 50,000 patients like Terry Schiavo today in the United States of America alone, people who, as far as we can tell, who are certainly alive, but there's no evidence for consciousness. Yet we accord, for example, much more legal protection to individuals like that than to any of our animals, any of our mammalian friends. So I think in the fullness of time, when this research is run its course, it will have all sorts of implications, including, of course, for our self-view. Thank you very much.